Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, reaction to forming a safe zone in Syria. An expert calls the trial of a U.S. reporter in Iran unfair. We're going to learn about improving our emotional intelligence.
How you are aware of yourself, how you regulate negative impulses, and how you are motivated for reasons beyond money.
And U.S. founding fathers hold a musical debate on Broadway, coming up right here on The Voice of America. Six U.S. F-16 fighter jets arrived at an airbase in southern Turkey Sunday to join the U.S.-led coalition fight against Islamic State militants, the U.S. military said. Turkey and the U.S. are planning joint military action to clear ISIS militants from an area near the Turkish border. Turkey's going forward with plans to establish a so-called safe zone in northern Syria. Turkey and Syria share a 900-kilometer border that is frequently used by militants to collect new recruits and supplies. International Edition's Mohammed El-Shenawy discussed the new plan with Michael O'Hanlon, Director of Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution. Say, Mohammed, did you get an explanation from him on the difference between the long-debated no-fly zone in Syria and this idea of a safe zone?
Yes, indeed, Sue. Michael O'Hanlon said the aerial action that has been described means that the safe zone will be very close to the definition of the no-fly zone when it comes to its actual net effect, in a sense that anything that flies once will not get a chance to fly again. However, he's not expecting that establishing such zone will eliminate the presence of the Islamic State or ISIL group from Syria.
There's no doubt that if ISIL is deprived of its major lines of logistical access to the outside world, that it will have to do a lot of things differently. A lot of its operations will become much more difficult. But I'm not sure that it will turn the tide of battle in a way that leads to the decisive defeat of ISIL.
One of the major objectives of establishing a safe zone in northern Syria is to have a springboard for the U.S.-trained Syrian fighters. But some of them have been captured by the other militant group called Nusra Front. How does that all work?
Well, Sue, according to Michael O'Hanlon, this strategy is not working even before these latest developments.
But we know that there was only a very small group that had been trained anyway. And so it looks like the whole effort is under-resourced and undersized for what needs to happen. So the capturing of several of the fighters is obviously regrettable, but I'm not sure it's the most central and important point. The most important point is that we never managed to find very many people who wanted to be part of this in the first place.
So with the military pressure emanating from the new U.S.-Turkish military cooperation inside Syria, convince Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to accept a political transition?
Most experts are skeptical about any compromise soon when it comes to the Syrian conflict, where trust between warring parties is in a very short supply. Let's listen to what O'Hanlon said about this scenario in particular.
I'm extremely skeptical that President Assad will accept the political process leading to a change of government. I think that he views the enemy in the most extreme and dire terms. He thinks the enemy is fundamentally made up of jihadists. Obviously, a lot of them are, but others may not be. But I think he conflates them all together. That's part of how he rationalizes in his own mind killing so many innocent people, because he's persuaded himself, or at least he wants to persuade himself, that he's in a fight to the death with groups that would never be reasonable if they were to take power. And given that he has that perspective, the idea that he's going to negotiate the end of his government in favor of even the more moderate elements of the opposition is quite unlikely.
Thank you, Mohammed, for exploring these aspects with Michael O'Hanlon over at Brookings.
Thank you, Sue, for having me.
Joining me here in the studio is reporter Andrew Palchevsky with a look at what is being said today in social media, and I've gotten a preview, and it's quite interesting. Andrew, take it away.
Well, there are two names that are trending today in social media. One is Robin Williams. It was 1 year ago today that he took his own life and died untimely death. And so people are sharing, as they did after his death, movies that he was in, fond memories, quotes. The one quote I've seen quite a lot on social media is, "Make your lives extraordinary," from Dead Poets Society. But what's changed in the past year is now we know the circumstances of his death. He was suffering from depression. He had been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. And so there's also a lot of advocacy for if you know someone that's depressed or if you think they're depressed, reach out to them and help them. So he's still doing good and still changing lives.
That's nice to hear.
After he's gone. The other name that's trending today is Nancy Reagan. I first saw this morning and I thought, like many other people, oh, she's sick or maybe she's passed away. But no, Nancy Reagan is alive and kicking, 94 years young, still going. And she's trending. She's trending because she invited all the Republican candidates to a debate next month at the Reagan Library. So a lot of people saying, oh, I thought she was dead, though. So Nancy Reagan, nope, she's alive and still involved in politics. So
that's
good
great.
For her.
That's good. I'm wondering if all 16 of them will show up.
We'll see. I'm sure it'll be a trending topic when they have that debate because it might be a bit of a fracas.
They're going to have a big podium for all those people.
Absolutely. Well, the Reagan Library is a big library, so I'm sure they can fit them all in.
Okay. Thank you, Andrew, for stopping by. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
An international team of scientists has spotted the most distant galaxy ever seen. Astrophysicists from the California Institute of Technology say that the galaxy called EGS 8P7 is the youngest such celestial object ever confirmed by spectrographic analysis. A spectrograph allows scientists to observe a spectrum of light or radiation from any source. This distant galaxy is being seen now as it was when the universe was less than 600 million years old. The astrophysicists say that finding galaxy EGS 8P7 provides new insight into how the universe evolved during its first few hundred million years of existence. They also say that the discovery brings scientists a giant step closer to looking back in time to the Big Bang. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
In Iran, the espionage trial of Washington Post reporter and dual U.S.-Iranian citizenship holder Jason Rezaian has concluded. The verdict is expected possibly later this week. Joining me here in the studio is International Edition's Jeffrey Young, and Jeffrey's been following this case. Say, Jeffrey, what's going on?
Well, Susan, this trial does not pass the test for fairness and proper procedure, according to Washington-based international law attorney Stephen Schneebaum.
Well, I think it quite clearly does not. In fact, I think it would be difficult to make any argument to the contrary. It doesn't pass the fairness test because it was conducted in secret, because his attorneys were denied the opportunity to meet with him and to make meaningful submissions to the court. It's not at all clear that the judges on this court are properly legally trained in order to render a verdict in accordance with the law. There are many, many defects in this trial.
What I understand, if you can explain this for people, dual citizenship does not always mean that your American or whatever passport is going to come to your rescue. Obviously, in Mr. Rezaian's case, this did not happen. And why?
Well, dual citizenship rarely comes to the rescue of individuals who are accused of violating the criminal law. Imagine, for example, someone picked up in this country for any number of different kinds of offenses. That person would be put on trial, irrespective of whether he or she happens also to hold a British passport or a German one or an Australian one. All that dual citizenship does is it allows the other country of nationality to espouse the case of the defendant, of the accused, and to raise diplomatic protests and to assert the rights of its citizen. But within the domestic legal system, citizenship is not a, I hate to use this term this week, it's not a trump card.
I understand that last month the Washington Post newspaper filed a petition with the United Nations Human Rights Council's Working Group on Arbitrary Detentions, trying to see if they can pressure Iran to release Jason Rezaian. Do they have any real tools to extract him?
I don't think they have any real tools to extract him, sadly, but they do speak to a very broad and wide audience around the world, and they speak for the international community. Now, this is a time when Iran appears to be making some efforts to behave, for the first time in many years, like a respectable sovereign nation. So this may be a time when the kind of pressure that the United Nations Human Rights Council can bring to bear would produce a greater reaction within the Islamic Republic than might have happened before the nuclear negotiations began, and certainly before they came to fruition. But it's hard to predict that.
That was international law attorney Stephen Schneebaum in Washington.
Some people wanted the Iran nuclear agreement to include the release of Jason and three other Americans held by Iran.
I asked attorney Schneebaum about that and why the release was not linked to the nuclear agreement. His answer, you're dealing with apples and oranges. The two issues don't mix.
Well, I can see some people's point of view that way, but to others disagree. Thanks for coming by, Jeffrey. Appreciate the interview.
Thank you, Susan.
Coming up on International Edition, Australia aims at cleaning the air, sharpening our emotional intelligence, and hip-hop goes historical on Broadway. Australia today announced targets for reductions in its greenhouse gas emissions. VOA Steve Herman reports from our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok.
Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott says his country, as part of a global climate deal, will strive to cut emissions 26% to 28% from levels a decade ago by the year 2030. In announcing the target, Mr. Abbott explained his country has to be both environmentally and economically responsible.
We've got to reduce our emissions, but we've got to reduce our emissions in ways which are consistent with continued strong growth, particularly with continued strong jobs growth. And the last thing we want to do is strengthen the environment and at the same time damage our economy.
Australian opposition politicians and environmentalists panned the proposal, which will be submitted to climate talks in Paris in December. Australia, on a per capita basis, is one of the world's biggest greenhouse gas emitters. Singapore-based clean energy entrepreneur Asad Razouk shares the skepticism Australia will achieve even the modest goal it is proposing.
That skepticism is driven by the fact that current Abbott government has disappointed consistently on this agenda by fighting clean energy domestically, as well as removing any mechanism to actually enforce anything that they're doing.
Razouk, chairman of the Association for Sustainable Investment in Asia, notes Australia's reliance on its inexpensive coal resources and its enthusiasm to promote exports of the carbon fuel, especially to China and India.
We know that coal must be phased out yesterday. We know that the health impacts from what they're doing are global and deadly.
The foreign minister of the low-lying Marshall Islands also expresses disappointment with Mr. Abbott's announcement. Tony DeBroom on Twitter commented that if the rest of the world follows Australia's lead, the Great Barrier Reef would disappear. So would my country. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Well, I heard about something today I've never heard about before, EQ, emotional intelligence. This EQ is supposed to help us in all sorts of ways. And to explain it all, from Florida is Karen Nutter, a corporate and lifestyle coach and author of the new book, The Power of EQ, Stronger Leadership Through Emotional Intelligence. Well, welcome to our show, Karen.
Thank you so much.
Oh, first off the bat, I don't know much about this at all. Matter of fact, I know nothing about it, so I'll ask you first off. Can you explain to us what is emotional intelligence?
Well, emotional intelligence, which is often referred to by the acronym EQ or EI, is the ability to sense, understand, and effectively apply the power and acumen of emotion so that you yourself can facilitate high levels of productivity and collaboration. So it's basically how you understand yourself and then how well you are at understanding yourself and others.
How can we get more EQ?
The way to get more EQ is to work with a coach or a mentor who can be honest with you, or maybe who implements an assessment like I do that helps the person understand maybe where their areas are that they could work on and then how to better those areas.
And how can this help us if we improve our EQ?
Well, it's going to help you in all areas of life. The five components of EQ are self-awareness, self-regulation, motivation, empathy, and social skills. So the first three, the self-awareness, self-regulation, and motivation, are the key to understanding yourself, how you are aware of yourself, how you regulate negative impulses, and how you are motivated for reasons beyond money. The next two, empathy and social skills, are how you interact with others, how much empathy you have towards others, and how you are able to manage networks and manage yourself within those networks. EQ can be elevated at any age. Your IQ stops.
This sounds like something that would be real good for a retreat, you know, where you go to the countryside with a bunch of other people and some instructors and just spend a couple days working on this sort of thing. Well, does more EQ necessarily mean more happiness in our lives, or can sometimes this sort of advance irritate your friends and family?
No, because the more EQ you have, the more you understand yourself. And for example, in corporate America, a true leader probably has a high level of EQ. You put two leaders together, and one who has maybe advanced degrees, a PhD, the other one maybe has a master's, which is certainly a nice degree to have, but maybe their EQ is higher. People are going to more want to follow that person than they are the one with the PhD whose maybe EQ is lower. So this is one area that the level of education does not necessarily come into play. It's more of self-awareness.
Well, thanks, Karen, for joining us today, and good luck with your book. Let me mention the title again, if you will, The Power of EQ, Stronger Leadership Through Emotional Intelligence. It sounds like we all can benefit from this.
Yes, we can, and thank you so much for your time.
You're tuned to VOA.
This is Greenbeat for a healthier planet.
The disappearance of forests leads to erosion, soil degradation, and other environmental problems. But much of what has been lost may be regained simply by planting trees. John Leary is the executive director of Trees for the Future.
Planting trees is a real critical anchor in the community, and it's kind of a real essential thing to return tree cover to the degraded lands.
Leary says they have planted more than 100 million trees since their inception about 25 years ago, and they are especially focused on sub-Saharan Africa.
And we guide farmers through the process of planting fast-growing and thorny trees that help revitalize and stabilize fields.
Last year, Trees for the Future put more than 20 million trees into the ground.
Really trying to help 4,000 families plant their way out of poverty.
The plan, says Leary, is to grow the program to reach 10,000 families in the next few years. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
Last Thursday evening, while the Republicans were holding their first U.S. presidential debate on television, this country's founding fathers were holding their own debates on Broadway with the opening of Hamilton, a new hip-hop musical by and starring Lin-Manuel Miranda. As Jeff London reports, the buzz has been growing for the show about Alexander Hamilton, the man on the U.S. $10 bill, since the show opened last winter off-Broadway, where it had a sold-out run.
Lin-Manuel Miranda has been working on Hamilton for 6 years. It started with him sitting on a beach, reading Ron Chernow's 832-page biography of the country's first Treasury Secretary, and realizing the story sang to him.
I feel like a mosquito that hit an artery. That's how I felt when I read Ron Chernow's book. I just thought, Hamilton's life story contains multitudes, particularly in the way Ron unlocked it, in the way that Hamilton is sort of the proto-American immigrant story, the trauma of his early years, and how that kind of created a crack in the foundation.
Biographer Chernow says he was initially skeptical that his book could be turned into a musical, much less one that uses rap as its main source of expression. But he agreed to meet with Miranda.
He came over to my house. He sat on my living room couch. He started snapping his fingers, and he sang the opening song. And I absolutely marveled at what he'd done, because I realized that he had condensed the first 40 pages of my book accurately into a 4.5-minute song.
Miranda performed that opening number at a poetry evening at the White House in 2009.
The $10 founding father without a father got a lot farther by working a lot harder, by being a lot smarter, by being a self-starter. By 14, they placed him in charge of the trade and charter.
Hamilton's life really was like a Dickensian novel, filled with coincidence and reversals of fortune. He brought himself out of poverty, emigrated to New York, and became a leading figure in the American Revolution as an aide to George Washington. He wrote most of the Federalist Papers, created the National Bank, was involved in the first national sex scandal, and managed to create enemies from Thomas Jefferson and James Madison to Aaron Burr, who famously killed Hamilton in a duel.
The fights we had then in the formation of our country will be the fights we have 100 years from now, 200 years from now. They will be, what is the role of the state versus the role of the larger country? What is our responsibility to other countries that are not our own? The two battles, cabinet battles in our show, are about those two things, because they're going to outlive us. We'll always be having those fights.
In telling this story from over 200 years ago, Miranda and his director, Thomas Kail, made the decision to have the show performed by a multiracial, multi-ethnic cast.
Tommy's goal was to eliminate any distance between a contemporary audience and this story. That's what the music aims to do. That's what the entire production aims to do. And so it's a story of America then told by what America looks like now.
I wanna be in the room where it happens, the room where it happens.
One of the repeated lines in Hamilton is, who lives, who dies, who tells your story? And Lin-Manuel Miranda wants to make sure that this story is told by as many different people as possible once the run on Broadway is done years from now.
When this is done as the school play, it opens up the show to the entire school. And that's something I'm really excited about.
Critics and audiences are already excited. The show received rave reviews on its Broadway opening, and the box office now tops $32 million. For VOA News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
Thanks for joining us today for International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
50 years ago this month, American democracy was born anew with the signing into law of the U.S. Voting Rights Act. Forged in the crucible of the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s, when black Americans and other minorities organized to end decades of discrimination against them, the law both reaffirmed their basic rights as citizens and revolutionized our political system. The act, signed by President Lyndon Johnson on August 6, 1965, affirmed blacks and other minorities' right to vote, a right that came with the fall of slavery a century earlier, but was often denied by political means. It struck down many procedures used in various cities and states to maintain white political control by limiting the votes of minorities. These included requirements that voters pay a tax to cast a ballot and be able to prove that they could read and write. It also provided federal oversight of elections where black voter registration was low, and it empowered the Attorney General to investigate other tactics used to suppress the vote. Almost overnight, black voter registration grew exponentially, most markedly in the South, where discrimination had been most pronounced. Since then, Congress has followed up by adding amendments several times, most notably by requiring bilingual elections, thus enfranchising foreign speakers as well as racial minorities. In the years to follow, our political leadership, from city halls to state houses to the U.S. Capitol and the White House, grew more diverse. By the mid-1990s, these moves and the broadening of the U.S. electorate they fostered had culminated in an almost complete realignment of our two major political parties. As the nation celebrates the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act and the great strides we've taken as a nation since, we also remember those who worked to make the law and its ideals a reality, securing for all the full blessings and privileges of American life.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.